Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. Friday, January 19, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Amanda Kraft from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, we want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present day, we have Senator Kaufman, Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, my vice chair, Senator Keel, myself, Senator Claymore. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 28, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records, sponsored by Representative Wright. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative Wright and his staff, Forrest Wolf. You both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Through the chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for hearing. Oh, my apologies. I'm Representative Stanley Wright from East Anchorage, District 22, and I have with me my chief of staff, Mr.
Forrest Wolf, for the record.
I'd like to thank you for hearing House Bill 28. House Bill 28 is an important but necessary step to opening up opportunities and reducing barriers for individuals who were convicted by low-level cannabis possession. And I'm going to go off record here. I'm off script. Please forgive me.
I'm not going to let this you go off record.
I appreciate that. You know, this legislation is meaningful. And it's going to help a lot of folks. It's something that a lot of folks have been looking forward to around Alaska so they can move on with their lives. There's so many individuals that want to rent apartments, get jobs, but they can't because of the records being online. It immediately stops them from being candidates. And it's truly unfortunate because these individuals, they're trying to move on with their lives and reach their full potential. So that's why I'm here today and fighting for this legislation. Now, the bill does two things. One of the things it does is it removes things, the records off of court view, which is important. And they've already taken that step and they've done it. Also, the state troopers, they have a background check that we would like to remove it out there as well, because at the end of the day, when you do a background check on an individual and it says they have a drug conviction, that's all it says. It doesn't say it's marijuana, and it puts them in a horrible space where they can't move forward and get a job, and now they're not a good candidate to continue the process. So I'd like to pass this over to my chief of staff, Mr. Forrest Wolf, to go through the sectional analysis.
Thank you, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Forrest Wolf, staff to Representative Wright. So I'll just quickly go over the sectional analysis here. Section 1 is intent language, stating that the intent of the bill is to reduce barriers to employment and other basic daily functions for individuals who, under past statutes, were convicted of low-level marijuana crimes. Section 2 describes when, why, and to which agencies or organizations this criminal justice information protected in the bill may be released. Section 3 establishes that an agency may not release the criminal justice information for low-level, non-violent marijuana possession charges, which are no longer crimes under current Alaska statute. And Section 4 deals with the court system and establishes that the records relating to the individuals and occurrences in this bill shall not be publicly published by the Alaska court system, and additionally, it establishes that the court system will state on its website that certain court records have been removed from the website and provide information on how to obtain such information that's been removed from public view. And then Section 5 is just the effective date. And with that, we'll take any questions. I also have Nancy Mead from the court system here and Lisa Purrington from the Department of Public Safety to answer any questions that might be a little more technical.
I would just note Section 5 lists an effective date of 2024, which was a several days ago. I assume that's an amendment that's needed.
We'll have to update that then.
Is there an interest in the effective date being sometime after passage of the bill, and that's the reason that January 1st date appears?
I believe it was just, I believe it was just we wanted to have it go into effect this year. But we will have to, like you said, change that to 2025.
Questions from the committee? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much. This is an excellent bill. I may know someone who might have a companion sponsor to it. I am curious about the date on page 1, line 8, and would just like a little bit more clarity as to why that is included in the intent language and what was the particulars of that date.
I'm not sure if there was a particular significance other than just that's kind of how the drafters came up with it for us. So it wasn't anything specific that we requested.
Senator Tobin, I think we listed your bill for next week. Is there a significant difference in your bill and this bill?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. This bill has gone through the committee process on the House side and has had some changes. So we will see that there are differences from the originally introduced bill to now.
Okay. Thank you. So originally they were identical, but they're no longer identical. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Senator Keel or Senator Giza?
Yeah. Thank you. I noticed that you had a change removing a fee. How did you have a fee to begin with to have their names removed?
So through the chair to Senator Giesel, that fee was added in the House Judiciary Committee. It was not in the original bill. And some of the committee members there felt that they would be comfortable passing the bill if there was a fee attached to it to reduce the fiscal note. That then was then removed in House Finance. So it's kind of was put in and then taken out. It was, like I said, it was not originally in the original version of the bill, so we're okay with it not being in there.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Wright, Mr. Wolf, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I think it's a worthy piece of legislation. I'm glad to see it here. I had a question. An issue arose, at least I became aware of it over the course of the summer, with regard to not our cannabis or marijuana laws, but the hemp products. Involving a slightly different cannabinoid. I think it was Delta 8 instead of Delta 9 THC. Is there any interaction with this bill? If someone had a product they were selling that had more than an allowable amount of that Delta 8, is that a, I guess the real question boils down to is, do we know if that's a scheduled substance or if is that simply a commercial substance that falls under our hemp rules? And if you don't know off the top of your head, I'm happy to look to the companion bill sponsor for an immediate answer or have someone get back to me.
Actually, the person that may be most qualified, if you don't know the answer, I think Ms. Purinton from the Department of Public Safety may be more capable of answering. She's not looking happy with that suggestion.
So through the chair to Senator Keel, I don't know that information off the top of my head, so I'd be more comfortable having Lisa Purinton or maybe Ms. Wilcox from the Marijuana Industry Association answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, if that's not immediately available, we can take it offline.
So why don't we start with Senator Tobin? Do you know the answer to that question? Okay. Ms. Purinton, do you know the answer to that question? And I see Lacey Wilcox. Do you know the answer to that question? Ms. Wilcox, if you please come forward, identify yourself for the record.
Hello, Lacey Wilcox, Legislative Liaison for the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association trade group representing licensed marijuana companies in Alaska. The hot hemp issue is what we've nicknamed it because that's a moving target with the Delta 9, Delta W, Delta whatever they come up with next is certainly an issue. I think this is a retrospective look back at convictions that this, if you were convicted of some hot hemp issue, you wouldn't be eligible because you couldn't be convicted for those things yet. Because of the U.S. Farm Bill and the status federally, these things are not necessarily going to lead to any conviction. They are, however, being regulated to a prohibited status within the state of Alaska for brick-and-mortar stores to be able to sell these products without a cannabis license. And those regulations have just recently been signed and are in effect, and enforcement's going to begin. It doesn't change that a young person can go on the internet and order these things delivered straight to their house, but they will not have been committing a crime if they do so.
Thank you. Follow up?
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Don't leave yet. Any other questions from Ms. Wilcox? All right, no. Now you get my question. You're relatively new to, I tend to be the last person to ask questions, so I want to give everybody else a chance. Hopefully then I don't have to ask any. Specific to this legislation, does that distinction between the hemp and marijuana, does that really have any impact here, or does that really not have any impact on what we're considering today?
No impact.
Thank you. Other questions either for the bill sponsor or his staff? I do have a question. In section 3, subparagraph 4, request the agency not release the records. If this is so important that we clean up these records so they're not accessible, why are we putting the burden on the individual, many of whom may lack the skill set of how to apply to the state to get the conviction taken off their, it's not taking it off their record, but essentially making the conviction information unavailable. Why are we putting the burden on that person rather than essentially saying to the Department of Public Safety, find all the folks and make all those records invisible?
Through the chair, just the system's really old, and it's not a light switch situation. It's more of a, they have to fine-tune, comb through it, and figure out who did what. And I think the representative from DPS could explain it better, but that's my understanding of it.
Ms. Purinton. Eventually, Mr. Wolf, you might get to keep your seat.
Thank you. For the record, Lisa Purinton, Division Director, Department of Public Safety, to the chair for your question. The system, the State Central Repository of Criminal History Records, is on a legacy mainframe system that has been in place since the late 80s. The department is currently working to replace that system, but right now it is the mainframe system. And over the past almost 40 years, the way the disposition information was stored in the system, it didn't always have a statute listed. It had a four-digit offense code. Some of the statutes didn't always have the subsections that would readily identify what that particular controlled substance was at the time or the weight of that controlled substance. So while there will be a portion that we could remove once we have the programming in place to affect that, some of those older records are going to take some time to manually review through the process. And that's why we have a fiscal note on here, number one, to hire a contract programmer to do the programming, because they don't teach that type of computer skill set nowadays. So we have specialized contractors that we've been working with to help support the mainframe, and then for temporary staffing to help research all those records to try to proactively remove the records in those first 2 years.
So that fiscal note would be there even with the person with the conviction applying. You still need that additional staffing to be able to figure out, is it appropriate to take that record out of the system?
Correct. Through the chair, yes, that would be correct.
Okay. So I guess the short answer to my question is way too complicated, way too expensive, and if it said thou shalt do it, you might not be able to do it.
Through the chair, that would be correct. It's because of the limitations on the technology on that mainframe system and the way the records were stored in the system. So we will proactively try to, like I said, programmatically remove a large swath of them for what we can programmatically identify. But some of those older ones will just take some human intervention to remove the records.
And is the way the information is entered what more similar to what you'd see in an absent printout that doesn't reflect the details of the conviction but gives you certain classes but not the same level that we would see in court records?
Through the chair, ABSIN, the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, is the state's criminal history repository, so what you're referring to is exactly what I'm talking about.
Senator Kaufman.
Through the chair to the bill sponsor, I would say, considering what was just discussed, is there a way you could anticipate the system being corrected and just put language in there to future-proof it. Where, so it was a manual on-demand process. But then once the system was updated, then it can become the more automated process. And that way you're leading the target on the improvement and creating the capability to shift to that mode. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I am open to any kind of amendment that will enhance the legislation.
Okay. Follow up.
Senator Kaufman.
Yeah, happy to work with you on that amendment.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. I think I have Ms. Mead listed as invited testimony. Did you have invited testimony you wanted to provide, or are you here more for questions? Okay, please come forward.
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I wanted to point out, as the bill sponsor said in his introduction, that Section 4, which is the only portion that refers to court view, as opposed to APSIN and DPS's official court records, is the section that impacts the court system, of course. And as the sponsor mentioned, the court system has already taken this step to remove all those records. There are no marijuana conviction records for marijuana possession of under an ounce for people over 21 left on the court system's website. The Supreme Court removed those effective in May of last year. So as a result, this bill will not change anything we do or cause us to do anything more.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you're here, and I'm happy to hear that. I do have one question. As I know in this section, it also provides notice to the public that those records have been removed that would be required to be published in the Alaska court system. Does the court system have that that disclaimer or that notice to the public that those records have been removed?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, yes, we've had that for a number of years that says certain records are removed, and I could show you, or you could go to our website. As soon as you go to court view, it says, here's how you get a real criminal history background check, and it highlights some cases have been removed because there are several categories that are removed. The court has a rule removing, I think, up to 15 categories of cases from court view. And we have a whole link about what those are. And we also have, if your case is on court view and you believe that's improper because you fit into one of these exceptions where it should not be, simply file this form and we will review it. And since the court view took all these cases off, the marijuana ones, we've had just one request for that. So it is maybe we did a great job.
I just comment. Thank you. That sounds very robust and very informative for the public.
Okay.
So on that topic, should we be, if we care about keeping those records off out of public view and specifically court view, should we be, should it be important to us to keep Section 4 in the bill saying that you really must do that, or can we, legislative branch look and see, well, the court system's already doing it and they're doing it in other areas that we probably didn't tell them we have to do. Should we be concerned about keeping this portion in the legislation, or should we consider removing it because you're already doing it? And I mean, how can you assure us that 6 years from now the court doesn't change path and start putting more information on court view?
To the chair, the court has never gone in that direction of putting more information on court view. Back in the early 2000s when court view began, and it was the belief sort of culturally that the more things online, the better, everything was online. And over the years and more recent years, as people began to see perhaps the flaws in having too much information available, too much information that might not be readily understood, or things that caused people distress that was out of proportion to the level of the crime, for example. So one of the biggest categories, for example, we take off is if somebody filed a domestic violence protective order and right away the judge said, nope, nothing to it, those used to be on court view and people would suffer consequences. The court determined that that was out of proportion to the action because it happened, but it wasn't quite appropriate for that person to perhaps have that advertisement online. So since I've been with the court in 2004, they've added and added categories of things that would be excluded from the online access. They have never gone the other way. And in fact, we're moving towards e-filing, and there's the thinking that things, more restrictions will be in place. It doesn't please everybody. Some people want everything on there. But I would guess there's a 99.9% chance the court would never repost these. It's a thing that's been legal now since 2014. And it just won't happen. So having that in the rule is obviously just as much of a law as having it in the statute. And that would be for the committee to consider whether Section 4 is necessary or not. And, it may not be. So
it's pursuant to court rule that it isn't on court view. That's not just something that's arbitrarily done by the administrator. Court view, those decisions are made through Supreme Court orders.
Oh, to the chair, absolutely. We have administrative rules, and our administrative rule 40, and I can provide a copy, is the rule on what is and is not on what we call public court view, because we have internal court view, which is, the index to every single thing. And it would have child in need of aid cases. It would have everything for our staff to use. And administrative rule 40 says, and all of that shall be made available to the public except, and that's where there are the 16 exceptions, including those domestic violence protective orders or cases where a charging document was never filed. And I guess it's exception number 15 are these marijuana cases described exactly as they are in the bill. So, yes, the Supreme Court must adopt those changes after full consideration.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We also have additional invited testimony. Unless there's other questions for the bill sponsor, we'll go to invited testimony. David Morgan. Mr. Morgan, are you in the room or is he on?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is David Morgan, and I am Legislative Affairs Associate with Reason Foundation. House Bill 28 is an important step for justice for Alaskans harmed by the war on drugs. Alaska was an early leader on cannabis reform, but now lags behind 24 other states that have already adopted reforms to conceal marijuana-related conviction records. Criminal records, as you know, can make it difficult for individuals to participate as productive members of society. For example, nearly 90% of employers nationwide conduct background checks on job applicants, and research suggests that job applicants with criminal convictions are approximately 50% less likely to receive a callback. Individuals with criminal records also face significant difficulty in engaging in other productive activities, such as securing housing, obtaining professional licenses, joining military, gaining admission to universities, accessing financial services, and maintaining child custody. It may sometimes be in the interest of public safety to track and provide information to the public about an individual's criminal record. But lifelong criminal record for conduct that is now legal in Alaska simply doesn't make sense. There is little to no evidence that providing these records and background checks contribute to public safety. Compared to other states that have legalized marijuana, this is a relatively small step toward fixing the damage caused by prohibition. Nonetheless, these reforms would provide much needed relief to many Alaskans. Again, thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Next, for invited testimony, we have Ryan Tunseth from the – actually, is he invited testimony or is he here for public testimony? Mr. Bill Sponsor?
For the record, Forrest Wolf, staff to represent Wright. I believe he's here for public testimony. I do not have my invited list.
All right. The other person I have listed for invited testimony is Ms. Purinton. We've already had her up answering questions. Did you have anything to add that we haven't asked already? Okay. Next, we're going to go ahead and go to public testimony. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not clear and is often difficult to hear what you're saying. I do see that Mr. Tumseth is on the line. Mr. Tumseth, if you want to proceed with your public testimony, we generally limit it to 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you, members of the Senate Judiciary. My name is Ryan Tunseth. I'm the president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. Through the Chair Klayman and Vice Chair Keel, thank you for having me. And thank you, Representative Wright, as well for this bill. This is an important bill. It's an important piece of legislation that we believe, you know, is an incremental step towards destigmatizing cannabis consumption. We've also submitted written comments about this that's on BASIS as well that you could read. As you may or may not know, last Friday, Health and Human Services released a request to the DEA to reclassify cannabis from a Class 1 controlled substance to a Class 3 controlled substance. And so certainly the landscape around cannabis is and has been changing. And, you know, anything that would remove even small barriers to positive life outcomes, that recognizes the damage that has been done by the failed war on drugs, we support. And we certainly support this bill. We think it's certainly a step in the right direction, and appreciate Representative Wright bringing this forward. I would just also say that I appreciate some of the comments that I've heard from both invited testimony as well as your committee. As it relates to sort of understanding cannabis as a whole. And I'll just offer a shameless plug here that I will be in the Capitol on the 31st. Our industry is holding a reception for all lawmakers on the 31st, and certainly would love any opportunity to meet with any of you, answer any questions you might have going forward. But just to reiterate, anything that removes even small barriers to positive life outcomes for the individuals affected by this, you know, we would support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else online. Is there anyone in the room that would like to provide public testimony? Yes, please come forward. Ms. Wilcox, welcome back.
Hi. Good afternoon. Lacey Wilcox, resident of Juneau, testifying on behalf of myself. I have been involved in smart justice reform and pro-cannabis policy for nearly 10 years, but my history with cannabis and its complicated legal status began as a youth born in Homer, Alaska, the home of some cannabis champions we're aware of, specifically Irwin Raven. I have watched growing up in my small town good-meaning people have to grapple with a really difficult choice to perhaps use a therapeutic medicine to treat their ailments or not use the therapeutic medicine for fear of the justice system. In both of these cases, there's a disastrous consequence. When you don't use your medicine, it can lead you to an addiction of a far stronger substance, such as opioids. I've watched that my whole life, and choosing to consume the alternative medicine for your pain or whatever ails you could lead to the consequences that create these barriers that we are discussing today. There's no easy choice, and there has been such a complicated history with our legal status that over the years it's been confusing for people to understand if you can grow, if you can smoke, if you can have it with you, what are the bounds based on a status that's changed at least 3 times in my lifetime. It is with this knowledge and background as an advocate for cannabis legalization and pro-therapy of natural medicine that I'm going to support HB 28 and have supported it. I do want to thank Representative Wright and prior session sponsors of similar legislation. I feel strongly it's time to see this move forward. I urge your support and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Anyone else in the room that would like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony. This time we're going to hold the bill for further review. Our second and last order of business today is Senate Bill 17, Campaign Contributions, sponsored by Senator Kawasaki's office. Here to present the bill is Senator Kawasaki and his staff, Joe Hayes. Would both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, Scott Kawasaki. I represent Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger.
Hold on just a second. The power screen is
too loud.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, for the record, Scott Kawasaki, Senator for Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger. Joe, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. For the record, Mr. Chair, Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki.
Once again, I wanted to thank this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senate Judiciary Committee members for being here today. Introducing Senate Bill 17. Senate Bill 17 is titled An Act Relating to Political Contributions and Providing for an Effective Date. There's a little bit of back history I'll go over is that Alaska has long regulated campaign contributions and limited the amount that can be donated to political campaigns by individuals, by other groups, even by out-of-state actors. Following some scandals in 2006, the people of Alaska approved a ballot initiative that established strict contribution limits. For you guys all know the $500 cap from individuals to candidates per year. Part of that argument behind the initiative was that limiting the amount of money candidates can raise or that contributors can donate would curb the type of corruption seen during those scandals. In 2019, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned some of Alaska's political contribution limits in this famous case, Thompson versus Hebden. Thompson's decision struck down what was the $500 limits, including limits from individuals, non-group entities, like political action committees, non-political party entities, and joint campaigns for governor and lieutenant governor. So what this bill seeks to do, Senate Bill 17, was to establish new campaign contribution limits that are compliant with this Thompson decision. It would increase the limits such that they are nearly indexed to the rate of inflation between the 2006 time that the $500 limit was established to 2023, which is last year. And we limited those to the nearest $100 just for ease. So what this bill would do is limit individual contributions from $500 to $700. That's, again, the change from 2006 to today. Non-political party groups would be limited from $1,000 to $1,400. Non-group entity limits would be from $1,000 to $1,400. Individual limits to a joint candidacy for governor or lieutenant governor would go from $1,000 to $1,400 also. The Thompson decision also stipulated that contribution limits must be indexed to inflation. So Senate Bill 17 requires APOC to index contribution limits for inflation by regulation, beginning after this bill passes into law every 4 years. So I would respectfully urge support for Senate Bill 17. And that's all for me, Mr. Chairman.
For the bill sponsor, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair, to the bill sponsor. Your talk references the VECO scandal a little bit before my time. I've heard about it, but how was it connected to, I guess, the campaign contribution limits?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. I think that more than anything, the public has really embraced the concept of having campaign contribution limits. Most people, if you would ask them, would probably be astounded to hear that we used to have $500 limits. Most of the people who I talk to are contributors in the $10 range. I think that when people hear the kinds of money that can get into campaigns, especially here at the federal level, they're pretty shocked. Most competitive congressional races, for instance, are at the million to the million and a half dollar level. That doesn't seem like a practical number for most of the public. So I think rather than, the Vico scandal was something that just happened, but I think that for sure that the public definitely prefers to see some limitations placed on the amount of money in individual elections and how much money is actually involved.
Senator Kaufman.
And one of the issues that I'm aware of is, so if contributions to candidates are limited, and actually that's all fairly transparent. We have extensive reporting of contributions and expenses that go to a candidate or to group through our APOC reporting system. The public may not be aware of that, but it's rather strident in its requirements and tabulates everything you take in, everything you spend, against either the organization, political organization, or the candidate. But we still have, the independent expenditure groups that do not have that transparency. So does this bill do anything to limit that?
So through the chair, Senator Kaufman, this bill only addresses the case dealing with Thompson versus Hebden. So that's only individual limits, political parties, and political action committees. So not what you're describing. That would be a much more, it would be a different part of law that we would be addressing that.
Senator Kaufman?
So in effect, this limits the very transparent reporting process that exists for the candidate, but leaves wide open the very obscure independent expenditure process, creating a very asymmetrical playing field.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, it doesn't actually limit the transparency, because the transparency, according to APOC, is still the same. So you would still have to report contributions over a certain amount. You'd still have to report them at those 30-day filings, the 10-day filing. You'd have to, if it's over, I think, $500 aggregate, you'd have to report in what's called a 24-hour report. Those things would still have to happen, whether or not this bill passes. What it would do is it would simply restrict the total dollar amount to the numbers that I mentioned.
Understood that. I wasn't saying it limits the transparency. I say it limits funding going into the most transparent system that we have. So the APOC reporting system, in comparison to independent expenditure spending versus what the candidate acquires and spends, that is the most transparent reporting that we have when you compare the independent expenditure process to what the candidate is reporting. So I'm saying it limits the money going through the most transparent system, not that it limits transparency. So to clarify my question.
Sure. I guess I'd be willing to look into that further. I think that the public would like to see where every dollar comes from. They want to know whether a person has funding from outside of state versus in-state. Various versions of this bill that have come forward since 2019 have had those types of filing requirements. This bill's much more simplified than that.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Kawasaki. I might be jumping ahead into your presentation. As I see on page 4, you provide a brief history of the initiatives that have gone into lowering limits for individual contributions. So I just want to bring our attention that this process of limiting contributions is as old as some of our legislative aides in this building, if not older. But I do have a question around the limits that are set in the legislation and if you're confident that those would avoid for further litigation.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, what we did was we essentially took the $500 individual limit and then indexed it based on inflation over that time. There's questions as to whether it should be higher or lower, but we think it's roughly where it would have been had it been indexed to inflation at $500 in 2006.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I saw on the slide you just had up a moment ago the overwhelming public support for the last time this was on the ballot. I dare say that if you asked Alaskans about limiting the contributions to $50, they'd probably say yes. I think the question that comes up when courts examine these, though, is not whether people want money out of politics, because that isn't really a question. It has to do, as if I'm understanding some of the past court cases, right, with the risk of quid pro quo, you know, tit for tat corruption or its appearance. Can you talk about maybe to some of the topics that Senator Kaufman was asking about? Can you talk about the difference between contributions where an individual hands a candidate a direct, discrete amount of money and the risk of corruption there versus something indirect and disconnected, uncoordinated, like independent expenditures that Senator Kaufman was asking about? Do you see those as different?
So right now, under the law, independent expenditure campaigns, they exist, and folks are probably pretty familiar with them. As long as they are not coordinating directly with the candidate, they're entirely legal. They're basically not able to work with the campaign committee that's advocating for the candidate. So I don't know if that answered your question, though.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keel.
It would seem as though something where you can't coordinate with the donor at all reduces the risk that donation is quid pro quo corruption in exchange for a specific act or position. And I wondered if that was your viewpoint and if you thought that was relevant to the defensibility of this approach in court.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, thank you for that. I do think that is a pretty definitive difference. But to Senator Kaufman's question about whether there should be some attachments to independent expenditure campaigns, I'd like to see that. I think the public would like to know where the money is coming from. And of course, we have had set some sunshine laws and transparency laws on third-party groups. So for instance, when a group is advocating for or against an initiative, they have to denote their top three donors, for instance. Those are the types of things that we could adopt. This bill doesn't deal specifically with that, but of course, when it comes down to money and politics, I think this is certainly a vehicle that we can discuss that too.
Thank you.
Just a couple of questions, because this has been a topic that's been, other legislation has been considered in the House a few years ago, and there was an initiative that was circulating. In your proposal, you're staying with annual limits. I think the recent ballot proposition that didn't get enough signatures and the legislation that was in the House a few years ago went from annual limits to campaign limits. Why not go to campaign limits?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, that's just not the way we drafted our bill when we drafted it. I recognize that, and there's a spokesperson of that particular ballot initiative that might want to talk about that aspect of it.
I'm asking from a policy perspective. I mean, I understand you drafted the bill differently, but why? I mean, you had that option. Why didn't you choose annual or campaign limits, which is similar to which is the same thing the federal campaigns do? They look at the whole campaign rather than the year.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just say that when I drafted this bill 3-4 years ago now, I did not take that into account. Okay. And that's just simply, I just used it because I've always been very familiar with the January 1 deadline for receiving contributions for the year, or the January 15th, the deadlines, the normal deadlines that we have. So.
Okay.
And through the chair, I do have Mr. Hayes here to go through a brief presentation, if it pleases the committee.
Please go ahead.
Through the chair, would you like me to go through the sectional analysis first?
Sure.
Okay.
Your presentation, you get to do as you wish. We just interrupt you with questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A sectional analysis for Senate Bill 17. Section 1, it amends the statute by increasing the individual contribution limit from $500 to $700. This applies to individuals donating to non-group entities, candidates, write-in candidates, or non-political party groups. Section 2 amends the statute by increasing the contribution limit for groups that are not political parties from $1,000 to $1,400. This applies to non-political party groups donating to a candidate, a write-in candidate, to another group, a non-group entity, or to a political party. Section 3 amends the statute by increasing the amount non-group entities can donate from $1,000 to $1,400. This applies to non-group entities donating to another non-group entity, to candidates, to write-in candidates, to groups, or to non-political parties, or to political parties, I'm sorry. Section 4 amends the statute by creating the amount individual and groups can donate to joint gubernatorial and lieutenant governor campaigns. It increases the amount individuals can donate from $1,000 to $1,400 and groups from $2,000 to $2,800. Section 5 adds a new subsection that indexes these campaign limits to inflation. Starting in 2024 and every term of 4 years thereafter, it shall be regulated to adjust these contribution limits to account for inflation. And Section 6, the bill will have an immediate effective date. And now, if there are no questions, Mr. Chair, I will go through the presentation.
No questions.
Okay, so the first slide is just showing what the increases to the limits on contributions will be from the different sections. Section 5, again, it relates to how the calculation will be done through the Consumer Price Index through the Municipality of Anchorage. Again, on page 4 is the brief history. In 1995, citizens filed an initiative that included lowering the limits on individual campaign contributions from $1,000 to $500. The legislature heard the call of the people and enacted a new law before the initiative came to fruition. The stated purpose of the new law was to restore the public's trust in the electoral process and to foster good government. The years later, the legislature raised the limit back to $1,000. In 2006, the people once again filed an initiative, and this time it came to be lowering the limits again to $500 with 73% support. In 2021, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the limits unconstitutional. So the courts argued that because $500 was unusually low, applied to all state races, and was not indexed with inflation to grow over time, that it infringed on donors' freedom of speech and gave an unfair advantage to incumbents. In the aftermath of the decision, the Alaska Public Offices Commission set the individual to candidate limit at $1,500. So SB 17 ceiling would roughly track inflation to what Alaskans approved in 2006, though a bit higher. So to review, the Ninth Circuit argued that since $500 was unusually low, applied to all state races, and was not indexed to inflation to grow over time, it infringed on donors' freedom of speech and gave an unfair advantage to incumbents. SB 17 limits are not unusually low and are indexed with inflation to grow over time. Thus, it follows from the ruling that these would survive a challenge made on the same grounds as the last case. And in 40 states that do have limits on contributions to legislative candidates, the average is $2,848 per election, ranging from $180 in Montana to $13,704. Ours would be slightly higher or lower depending on the source of the contribution, not unusually. Again, we're showing what the increases will be per each category. And then now you may be familiar with some of these related cases. In the McCutcheon versus Federal Elections Commission 2014, the courts held that states cannot place limits on aggregate contributions, the total of all contributions to all candidates by individuals or groups. Existing limits on per candidate contributions were not addressed and thus not changed. And also in the Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission case in 2010, independent expenditures were at hand. Senate Bill 17 would not limit those, which I think addresses Senator Kaufman's question. And again, we showed So now we have a definition. Okay. So with that, we are open again for questions. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and they are different, so I will address each one separately. The first is from slide 3, where you use the consumer price index for all urban consumers based in Anchorage. And why did you select Anchorage, as we know the disparity between our urban and rural districts is rather high?
Thank you for the question, Senator Tobin, through the chair. Really, the only place in Alaska that consistently has calculated consumer price index is Anchorage, Alaska. It's it's the calculation that, for instance, the Fairbanks City Council uses for its labor contracts. I mean, it's just the best pinpointed number that's continually information gathered. So I recognize it's probably not the best, but it's the only figure that we could pin down as regularly evaluated.
Thank you. Second question, not necessarily a follow-up, but this one is from slide six. So I see here that you indicate that 500 is unusually low. And so by using 500 as your starting point, I am still very curious about this potential future litigation that could result in basing your number off of that. And I also notice here on the third paragraph you use per election, and I'm curious if per election means state and gubernatorial combined, as I notice that there are differences between state and gubernatorial limits. And so I'm curious, I can't do math off the fly, that is not my skill set. What is the Alaska average? If you calculated it here, how would we fall within that spectrum with your set limit? So would we fall between 180 and 13,704? Based on your numbers, what would the Alaska average be?
What's that? Okay. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I think we're going to have to figure that out, do some math ourselves.
We'll just take a minute while they do the math. Or do you want to take Senator Kaufman's question and then Mr. Hayes can do the math while you go ahead and finish the math while he asks his question? We'll put Senator Kawasaki on the spot.
They need a moment of silence.
All right, we'll take a pause while you do the math.
Talk about being in the hot seat.
Okay. You want to get back to us?
I guess so. Yeah, through the chair, we'll have to get to that number at a later time. But I do know that there are people that might want to testify. If you want to take them, maybe we could do the math.
Senator Kaufman, do you have a question?
Yes, sir.
Please.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. Just looked up the campaign finance limits for Senate, U.S. House of Representatives. Looks like it's $3,300 per election right now. And I was just thinking specifically, you have the governor and lieutenant governor campaigns. Those are statewide races, the same magnitude as one, you know, that would have pursuing any other statewide. You know, so I'm just wondering the rationale behind having those limits at, you know, a third below of what the statewide limits are effectively for the federal seats that are running. It seems like they have, you know, the same burden in mounting a statewide campaign. Just wondering if just defaulting to, if you're going to have limits, just default to the federal limits, which are already inflation adjusted.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I'll just say that the state has always had limits that are different than the federal limits. I understand what you're saying when you say that a gubernatorial candidate would have to campaign the same over the same area and same number of people as a congressional candidate or a Senate candidate would be. But they are pretty distinctly different races, in my opinion.
Follow it?
Senator Kaufman?
Maybe we could kick this around offline. I think it's just simply respecting the effort and the cost of the campaign. It just seems to me like the two are aligned. I guess I'm, but I look forward to, you know, further conversations about it. Thank you.
So I don't see other questions. We're going to go ahead and open public testimony. And start out, if there's anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony, we do have someone. It must be Mr. Race. If you could please come forward, identify yourself for the record. We tend to limit public testimony 2 minutes per person.
Boy, that's all right. I'll talk fast then. For the record, my name is Patrick Race. First, I'd like to address Kaufman's question about the Vico scandal. It was not a one-time incident. It was a long-running scandal that led up to the events in Vico in 1983. Bill Allen illegally had many of his employees give he made donations to campaigns under the names of his employees. He was found guilty for that. It was he contributed something like $41,000 from 415 employees. So the idea of campaign limits is tied directly to the history of the Vico scandal. Ballot proposition that Senator Klayman referenced did not fail to get enough signatures. It failed to get enough signatures in time for this election. We stood up this initiative signature gathering process in November. So we've only been gathering signatures for a few months. We have quite a few. We will put this on the ballot if the legislature doesn't act. I think the legislature should act. I think, you know, we've got retired judges and legislators and my mom out there in the cold gathering signatures, and I think that's work they shouldn't have to do. I think that's work you should have to do in here in the warm. And I think that with respect to the 73% of Alaskan voters who passed this initiative in 2006, or these campaign contribution limits in 2006, we shouldn't have to be out there gathering signatures. You should make this process happen in the legislature this year. Question of why would we bother fixing this when the federal rules are create this cloudy miasma of shadowy dark money donors. I think that, you know, if the pipeline has a leak, we're not going to ignore that leak because there's another leak up the road. We're going to fix both leaks. So I think we fix both the problems, and this is a problem not having campaign contribution limits because. Jump back to my testimony here. Because money wins elections.
Mr. Race, you're at about the two-minute mark. Why don't you go ahead and conclude your remarks?
I would love to conclude my remarks, and I'll send in some more written testimony. I'm not married to any particular number here. I trust you guys to come up with a good number, but I do think it can't be infinity.
Thank you. Anyone else in the room who would like to provide public testimony? I'll then turn to online. That looks like Ms. Hebden, I think you're here to answer questions. Jim Sykes, looks like you're here for public testimony. If you want to proceed, identify yourself for the record, and you've got 2 minutes. Hello? Mr. Sykes, can you hear us?
Yeah. Oh, is this better?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Go ahead and I'll restart the clock. Go ahead and identify yourself and make sure you're not on a speakerphone.
Okay. My name is Jim Sykes. I live on Lazy Mountain outside of Palmer. I just want to express my support for SB 17 and thank the sponsor, Senator Kawasaki. I remember the term limits that we originally had for a long time. And I think that Alaskans just really like those small limits because I don't think that people give a lot to the campaigns, but they want to hear directly from the people and they don't like outside money coming in. And I think that limiting it is a real good idea. And I'd like to get back to that because I thought we had less bad political influence when we had that existing law. And that's all I've got. I wish you well, and I hope you'll support this. I think it's a great idea, and I think most Alaskans will support it.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else online, and I don't see anyone else in the room, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 17. We'll hold the bill for further review. I will note we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, January 22nd at 1:30 p.m. If you're considering offering an amendment to House Bill 28, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records, sponsored by Representative Wright's office, go ahead and let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, January 24th. I am not setting a amendment deadline for Senate Bill 17. It sounds like there's a lot of discussion folks may want to have with the bill sponsor before we hear it again. So with that, we are going to adjourn for the day. The time is now 2:32 p.m.